Listen. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim, each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then flew one of the seraphim to me, having in his hand a burning coal, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin is forgiven." And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" Then I said, "Here am I. Send me." And he said, "Go." It was a hot July evening on the campus of the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. A friend and I were lying on the cool green grass in front of Ayers Hall on the hill. We were entering into our senior year, and we were getting quite philosophical about what the future held for us. I said to him, "You are so fortunate. You know what you want to do with your life." He was a transportation major. He loved trains. Everywhere he went, he would seek out the trains and he would make pictures of trains. He was obsessed with trains. He would spend the rest of his life doing the thing that he enjoyed most of all. When I went away to college, I was to be an architect, and I still love architecture. After a while, I came to realize that architecture was not my calling, and then I went into pre-law. I would love to be a lawyer today. I love the fascination of the practice of law. But somehow I felt this was not what I wanted to spend the rest of my life doing. And so I despaired. I said to him, "I don't know what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. I have no real sense of calling." A few weeks after that, Billy Graham came to Lake Junaluska to speak to a missions conference, and my friend and I went to hear him. He was just emerging on the national scene, and crowds were coming out in great numbers to hear him. Still enough unknown that we were able to get a seat in the Stewart Auditorium on the beautiful Lake Junaluska. As I sat and looked at Billy Graham standing on the podium, I remarked to my friend, "Look how he's dressed." He had on a light cotton summer suit, and so did I. He had on white buckskin shoes, and so did I. We were about the same height. I had more hair then. The appearance of Billy Graham standing on stage and me sitting in the audience was a striking resemblance. There was nothing evangelical about the meeting. He was there speaking to returned missionaries, and the subject of his sermon that evening was, "Watchman, what of the night?" But when that evening was over, I knew what my call was to be. My parents had come down to hear Billy Graham, and I approached them and told them that I didn't know exactly what I would be doing, but I knew that it would be church-related. And from that moment on, I began my journey into the ministry. it was over, I had gone to where my parents were and some friends who had come with them, and we were talking rather animatedly. The small grouping of us had attracted the attention of others, and after a while, I saw that the people were queuing up. I turned, and this older lady reached out her hand, and she said, "Brother, that was such a wonderful sermon tonight." And I graciously accepted her compliment. I didn't want to disillusion her. But when she stepped away, another lady stepped up, and I saw that they were lined up to speak to me. So I made a hasty retreat. But I know one lady who spent the rest of her life boasting to her friends, "I got to shake the hand of Billy Graham at Lake Junaluska." I stalled in my getting into the ministry. I was licensed to preach at Church Street Church in Knoxville, and on the following annual conference, the girl that I was dating on campus and I had spent the afternoon out driving, enjoying the spring weather, came into Church Street that evening to church, and Robert Wilcox, the associate minister, said, "Vance, congratulations." And I said, "Congratulations for what?" And he said, "For your appointment. The bishop appointed you to a church today." And so I was appointed while a student to a church, having preached only one sermon, knew nothing at all about preaching. And then after finishing my first year in seminary, I was to be ordained deacon in Chattanooga. Our finances were rather meager, and so I drove in from Knoxville to Chattanooga for my ordination. I thought it was at Centenary Church, and I got there just in time for the service to begin, and then learned that it was at another church in the city. And I raced across the city to walk into the auditorium in time to see my ordination class kneeling and the bishop placing his hand on the head of each. I walked down the aisle and took my place just in time for him to put his hand on my head. I almost didn't make it in there. Each of you has what Peter Marshall called the tap on the shoulder. This is how mine came, and your way is far more interesting, perhaps, far more dramatic. But whatever might have been your call, in that moment you moved into a new arena of living. You had turned your back upon the kind of life that most people normally seek for themselves, knowing that hereafter you would be walking in the presence of the one who guides and leads. You would be walking in step with the Master. When I was pastor of the church in Gatlinburg back in the 60s, Bishop Finger came to our area as our bishop, and he was ambitious to recruit some of the finest young men and women to the ministry. He was serving both the Holston and the Tennessee conferences at that time, and so he had all the ministers of the churches to choose from their congregation young men and women who were either seniors in high school or were in college, who had not made a decision for the ministry, but who showed unusual gifts. He invited all of these to Gatlinburg for a weekend, along with the leading ministers of both conferences as counselors. And James Armstrong, who would later become a bishop of the church and president of the World Council of Churches, was invited to come to be the speaker for the weekend. Bishop Finger said to me, as the host minister, "Vance, on Sunday morning, I want you to preach the sermon, at the close of which I want you to extend an invitation for these young men and women to commit themselves to the ministry of the church." I was floored. After the speaking of someone as eloquent as James Armstrong, sitting in the small groups under the leadership of these outstanding veteran pastors, and I was to give the invitation, which I did. And interestingly enough, one of the leading young men in our conference said to me just a year ago, "You know, it was on that occasion that I decided to go into the ministry." I don't know what I preached on that morning other than the title. And the title was, "Run for Your Life." That can be looked at either side and have meaning. But if I were given that opportunity now to address a group of young men and women who showed unusual gifts, but who had not considered going into the ministry, I know now what I would say. I would say there is no vocation into which you can enter that will offer greater rewards than the ministry. It offers intellectual rewards. I was in a bookstore on one occasion, and a woman nearby was thumbing through the books, and she said, "I wish I had more time to read." And I thought, how fortunate I am, because I do. Harry Emerson Fosdick said that he spent 1 hour in his study for every minute he stood in the pulpit. Few of us had that kind of luxury of time. But the mandate is, when you stand in the pulpit, you are informed, you can be believed, your message is authentic. And the only way in which you can stand in the pulpit and make such a presentation is because you have labored over many books and magazines understanding what it is you're about to say. And it isn't just in the realm of theology. The people sitting in the pews are hurting, and for many reasons. And they need to have their needs addressed. Early in my ministry, while I was still a student in seminary, I learned some theological facts at seminary that I was so eager to share with my congregation. Now, I was a little bit selfish in it, too. I wanted them to know how brilliant I was. This was an idea that I'd never confronted before. It was a little country church, and I stood up in the pulpit so proud, and I began to spiel out with all the theological jargon what I had learned in seminary that week. And then at the close of the service, I went down to the door of the church waiting for people to tell me what a learned sermon that was. And then an elderly woman came up and paused for a moment, and she said, "Today is the anniversary of my son's death. He died in World War II, and he was buried at sea. And when I came to church this morning, I wanted something to be said that would give me the assurance that I had not lost my son, that he was still mine in spiritual ways." And I shrank. I took a vow then that I would never again preach an intellectual sermon for the sake of presenting theology, except in a learning environment. Hereafter, I would look into the faces of the people in the pew, and I would anticipate, by my knowing my congregation, where they were, where their hurts were, what they were struggling with, and this was what I would talk to them about. And I never let that vow grow cold. It is an opportunity that a person gives you 20 or 30 minutes of their time to listen to every word that you say, and what an opportunity it is to change the lives of people by making them leave feeling closer to God than when they came into the church. There's no greater challenge on earth than that. Standing before people and bringing them closer to God and letting them walk away more confident, more assured, more filled with love than when you began speaking. That's what I would say to these young men and women now in the challenge to become a minister. And I would share with them the social rewards that are theirs. I don't know anyone who is more welcome into the homes of strangers than a minister appointed to that community. In fact, if you don't come, you're going to get criticized. It's not whether or not you may come. And whether it's a hovel or whether it's a beautiful mansion, the welcome is the same. And you have the opportunity to enter into people's homes and share with them in the things that are meaningful to them. the social contacts that we have as ministers, as a group of people, our peers, coming together and talking about the things that really give us great pleasure and excitement, and always respected in the community. Time was when the parson was the person of the community, and in a sense that has never tarnished, he still is one who is automatically received, accepted, and respected in the community. What other profession will offer you that from the very beginning? You don't have to earn it. You can lose it, but you don't have to earn it. From the very beginning, you're a part of the great community of social life of those of your congregation. And I would tell them that there are great spiritual rewards. There may not be many material rewards. For some, there are. I was so humbled the last year of my ministry when I studied the disciples study with a group of lay ministers who were struggling to make ends meet and serving a number of churches, driving many miles from one to the other. And of the years of my having been in churches far away from that, being reminded of those who served in such ways, I felt myself humbled, and I began to appreciate even greater those who feel the call to ministry. But none of them were reluctant in doing so because of the great spiritual rewards that come in hearing our Master say, "Well done." This is what I would say if I were addressing those who had not yet made a commitment, but who had the gifts for being great servants of God. We here who have spent our life in Holston Conference ministering have a greater appreciation than any of the others of you can imagine for the great opportunity that has been ours among the most wonderful people on earth. I defy anyone to show me any conference that can tower above Holston Conference. The people are down to earth, filled with love, good Tennessee values, Virginia ideals. This is a conference that has enriched the lives of all of us who have walked up and down her valleys, who have walked by her streams, who have climbed her mountain peaks. What a privilege it is to be able to work in the most beautiful part of the world and to spend our life discovering for ourselves God in all of it. Began really in 1773 when Edward Cox came from Baltimore into the Holston country. He had been converted by Francis Asbury, and the first thing he did was to open his home to those who wanted to be Methodists. 10 years later, Jeremiah Lambert was appointed to the Holston Circuit. It comprised all of Tennessee and Virginia that was between the Cumberland Mountains and New River in Virginia, the Great Smoky Mountains reaching into North Carolina, down into Georgia and South Carolina. One circuit rider riding over that vast circuit, beginning to spread the message of Wesley to the people in the frontier, and how it caught on and how it grew. And over the years, following the history of Holston Conference, one rides upon the shoulders of magnificent men and women who took seriously the call of taking the bread out into the wilderness and putting the water to the lips of those who were spiritually thirsty. And to be in that endless line of splendor is a reward that one cannot even begin to describe. Ours is a great church. Ours is a great conference. And we who have ridden her paths and now have taken a moment to rest have a great fellowship of remembering and sharing as our paths cross through the lives of people. Not only did I have the privilege of challenging the young men and women to become ministers, on the occasion of my retirement, I had the high privilege of passing the mantle on behalf of my retiring class to those who were coming in. The bishop didn't give me a chance to talk this time. Ah, but if he had, what I could have said. I could have said, over the years of my ministry, I can say some things to you who are just beginning. it can make your ministry so much more meaningful. I would have said, fall in love. I heard a tribute to Minnie Pearl last week on CBS, and she told about her first appearance at the Grand Ole Opry, and she said, I was so scared, I didn't know what I was going to do when I got on stage. And she said, the master of ceremonies, whom they call the solemn old judge, said, young lady, you're nervous, aren't you? And she said, I sure am. And he said, just go out on the stage and love them, and they'll love you back. I mentioned my first appointment that came to a surprise to a senior at the university. It was to Brookside Methodist Church in the heart of the industrial center of Knoxville. These were milk folk who went to that church. I went in to see the district superintendent to see what it was all about, and he said, there's not a thing in the world you can do for those people. Just go in and love them. And love, I tried. I had never really mingled with people who were so mismatched to life. Prison families, families who didn't have enough to eat on their table. But there was Aunt Mandy, who lived in a shotgun house down the street, and she just could love more than anybody I ever knew. And she taught me how to accept people for who they were, to appreciate them for who they were, and to love them. And one of the members of the church she attended, she wasn't a member, she was a Baptist, learned that I liked banana cake, and she baked one for me for a meal that was being held at the Wesley Settlement House there in the community. And she suffered a heart attack while she was baking the cake, and her husband tried to get her to lie down, and she said, not till I get this cake finished. And when I learned of that, it was hard to eat that cake. But I appreciated the love that one had expressed in wanting to do something for the young preacher who was just starting out in their community. Don't be afraid to love. And love people not for what you want them to be, but for who they are. And I would say, get in a rut. Make every day a repetition of the day before, in getting into God's presence and talking to Him and taking down the book and reading the things that He inspires you to read, and get in a rut, a discipline of knowing the things that need to be done and going out and doing them the best that you can, and not letting life float through the day simply because you have the privilege of making up your own schedule. But get in a rut and don't get out of it. And I would say, get out of the middle of the road. When I was serving my second pastorate out of seminary, I spoke to a college gathering at chapel. And at the close of the chapel service, one of the leading ministers of our conference, who was in retirement and was on the staff at the college, called me to his office, and he said, Vance, you're just starting out your ministry. Let me give you a word of advice. Stay in the middle of the road and you'll get to the top. Man, I couldn't stay in the middle of the road. I'm too opinionated. I was always getting involved in issues on the side of the road. I kept getting out of the middle of the road and taking unpopular positions. Someone said to me once, why is it every time you get up at annual conference, there's always a crisis that follows? And it usually became that, because I was willing to take unpopular positions when my conscience led me to do it. But with an appreciation for those who thought differently, I would say to them, stand up for what you believe and let your people know where you stand, because they're wanting to know where they should stand, and they're looking to you to lead them. Don't impose what you believe, but be free to stand for what you believe, especially if it's important. And I would say, warm up your heart. The congregation is full of sinners, and sinners are so easy to dislike because of the lifestyle they've chosen and the values that they live by. And it's so easy for us to compartmentalize people outside of the church, unlike ourselves, and give them only a fragment of ourselves, passing judgment all the while. I learned that lesson quite graphically late in my ministry. I had a young man who came to my community and was a member of my church from New York City. He was a male model in New York and was organist at one of the leading churches in the city. But his mother had moved back to that town from Birmingham, and she was getting old, living alone, and he came back to live with her. And he became active in our church. As talented as he was, he didn't ask for a position of exposure. He sang in the choir. He was quite adept at directing dramas, and so he developed a community theater there. And he brought in people from the community who could act, and some of the finest presentations were made. He was so skilled. He developed an orchestra, and he directed the orchestra that would rival a city much larger than that in their amateur presentations. I was feeling such strong feelings about homosexuality because it was in the forefront at General Conference where decisions were being made about homosexuality. And I was very forthright in letting the people just what I know, just how I felt about it. And so from time to time, as I talked about the social issues, I didn't pull any punches in condemning those who wanted to be a part of the ministry and practice homosexuality. This young man was always appreciative of me. He complimented me in many ways, even offered me two of the leading roles in his productions in the little theater, which I quickly declined. I couldn't memorize a line, and I wasn't going to embarrass myself like that. But I was flattered that he offered them to me. And then one day I was told that he was in the hospital in Knoxville. I went in to see him. I couldn't believe that this young man was the one that I knew. He had lost so much weight. They made me put on a mask before I went into the room. And there he lay, so vulnerable, at the point of dying. And he said, "Vance, I guess you know I have AIDS. I have lived a homosexual lifestyle. I have a brother who is a Baptist minister who has condemned homosexuality and has told his congregation repeatedly that AIDS was God's punishment of homosexuals. And I had to listen to that from him. But he came into my room yesterday and he hugged me. And for the first time in my life, my brother said, 'I love you.' And all at once, I wanted to hug him too. I felt such a pain for him, such a love for his vulnerability and his hurting. But I had on a mask and a gown, and they told me to keep my distance because if I had a germ, he would get it. And I left that room with another appreciation for those that we are so quick to condemn. Behind every condemnation, there's a person to be loved. Hate the sin, but love the sinner. It's hard, but Jesus did. And now this. And the most valuable resource in the Methodist Church today, untapped, is that vast cadre of retired Methodist ministers. The experiences that we have, the struggles through which we've come, the lessons we've learned. Just when our nation begins to call into public service their elder statesmen, they put us out to sit down and watch the parade go by. Use us. We've got so much stored up, eager to share. Father, thank you for the tap on the shoulder that said, "Come, follow me, and I will make you to become fishers of men." Amen.